Today, is the Australian fair-go broken? Hello again, it's Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Welcome to this post covering finance and property news. When I landed in Australia back in 1995, I was immediately struck by the concept of a fair go being right at the heart of the Australian psyche. But more recently, it appeared to me that this was becoming something of a myth as inequality and poverty started to expand and impinge on people who previously were able to get on, buy a house and enjoy the Australian dream. The Productivity Commission just released a research paper titled Fairly Equal? Economic Mobility in Australia, and makes the point that inequality is a serious concern when people at the bottom of the income distribution cannot meet their basic needs or where they experience the stress of economic insecurity. And inequality is a serious concern if it limits people's future opportunities. The countries with the highest inequality are also the countries with the lowest intergenerational mobility, with children from poor families more likely to be poor themselves. So they looked at so-called economic mobility, encompassing mobility over the course of one's life, mobility from one generation to the next, and the chances of escaping from poverty. And they say that Australia has high relative income mobility compared with the US, UK, and Canada. A person's rank in the income distribution is less influenced by their parents' rank than in many other countries, including Scandinavian countries. In Australia, a 10 percentile rise in a parent's rank in the income distribution is linked to a relatively small 1.8 percentile rise to the children's rank. This indicates very high equality of opportunity in terms of incomes. And they say Australia's long-term economic growth has led to each generation earning more income than the last. On average, most Australians, 67% of those born between 1976 and 1982, earn more than their parents did of a similar age. And this is particularly true of those born in poorer families. However, gains have slowed for people born in the 1990s. They have seen essentially no increase in income between the ages of 25 and 30, compared to those born in the previous decade. And when you dig further into the report, things look even less impressive. While there is substantial mobility across the income distribution, there is some persistence at both the top and the bottom. Children with parents at the bottom or top income deciles are relatively more likely to remain in the bottom or top deciles themselves. Almost 15% of people with parents in the bottom income decile remained in the bottom decile, while just 6% of them ended up in the top decile. In contrast, just 7% of people with parents in the top decile ended up in the bottom decile, with 20% remaining in the top decile. Intergenerational disadvantage can also be reflected in poverty being passed on from parents to their children, as well as through the persistence of government support payments, such as disability, care, and unemployment payments. And there are worrying signs that people experiencing poverty face particular difficulties moving up the income distribution. This is a concern because although interrupted by the COVID-19 pandemic, Australia's poverty rate has steadily increased over the past two decades. In fact, survey data suggests the rate of poverty is the highest since 2001. Almost 14% of Australians experienced poverty in 2022, or about one in seven people. And the poverty rate was 13.7% based on income alone, and 14.4% after accounting for housing costs. People most at risk of poverty include those not in paid employment, who come from a migrant background, and who do not speak English at home, over the age of 65, who rent housing, and in a single person or single parent household. Poverty varies significantly, though, between regions, which means where you live also affects your likelihood of experiencing poverty. Poverty rates are generally lower in cities, but there are some pockets of high poverty, particularly in some local areas with relatively high housing costs. Some of the highest concentrations of poverty, though, are in regional and very remote areas. Although regional and remote poverty rates are somewhat moderated once their relatively lower housing costs are taken into account, people living in those areas often face considerably higher prices for everyday items than people living in cities. And how long poverty lasts matters as much as how many people it affects. Longer periods of poverty are harder to exit, particularly as people age. Persistent poverty is also associated with going without essential goods and services such as medical treatment and heating. And women are in fact more likely to experience persistent poverty than men. And poverty is intergenerational. Children who experience poverty are at increased risk of poverty as adults. Children who grew up in a family that received government support payments are twice as likely to receive support payments themselves compared to children whose families did not receive support payments. And poverty is quite a common experience, but most people spend a relatively short time in poverty. Around half of poverty spells are for a year or less. But there remains a significant number of people for whom poverty is ongoing. About 10% of Australians experienced poverty in at least three of the last 5 years, between 2018 and 2022. And people who previously experienced poverty were about 2.5 times more likely to re-enter poverty than those who never experienced it. This experience of persistent poverty is in spite of the additional government support provided to low-income earners during the COVID-19 pandemic. And younger people are more likely to exit poverty, but people who rent, people with lower education levels, and those with long-term health conditions are more likely to remain in poverty. And people who live in disadvantaged neighbourhoods are also less likely to exit poverty, even after other characteristics are considered. And people who live in remote locations in adulthood are also likely to remain in poverty over time. Now, in terms of decoding what affects economic mobility, the report says education is a gateway to many opportunities. People with a bachelor's degree or higher earn 23% more than people with a year 12 qualification on average over a lifetime. If a student misses out on early education opportunities because of family circumstances, financial barriers, or local school accessibility, can they recover? Well, Australia has very few age restrictions on attending vocational education or university, and many pathways to entry do exist, but not everybody takes up those pathways. And adverse life events such as job loss, health problems, and relationship breakdowns can reduce income and do not impact everyone equally. Job loss in particular has a persistent negative impact on income and is more likely to be experienced by people who start on low incomes. The negative impact of health problems on income worsens over time, possibly because the health effects persist, particularly for those on low incomes. That said, lifetime income mobility is high, with most people moving across the income distribution at different points in their life, and many people can avail themselves of new opportunities as their circumstances change. For example, after relationship separation, women's incomes recover in about 4 years. Then, of course, housing costs vary according to the type, size, and location of the dwelling, as well as how housing is financed. If there is an increase in the cost of low-quality rental housing, households have little option but to pay higher prices. This is reflected in the fact that two-thirds of renting households in the bottom 40% of the income distribution spent more than 30% of their disposable income on housing. Poverty estimates that account for those differences will actually provide more information about the subsequent level of people's economic resources. Homeowners who've paid off their mortgages typically have much lower housing costs and so have more income available for other consumption than people servicing a mortgage or paying rent. And in contrast, people who are paying off a mortgage or renting have much less disposable income remaining after paying those housing costs. Moreover, renters may receive additional income from government-provided rental assistance, and when examining only income, this may make renters appear to have a lower risk of poverty. But since rents are typically higher than rental assistance, renters may have less income available to spend on other necessities to support their well-being and are actually at more risk of poverty. And for example, before accounting for housing, many older Australians have incomes at just around the poverty line. This is because the age pension sits just below the poverty line, putting older people without other income in poverty. However, while those receiving additional rent assistance instead have income above the poverty line when housing costs are not accounted for, studies have found that after accounting for housing costs, poverty rates are about 50% for the 1 in 8 older Australians who rent their homes. Home ownership rates have also collapsed, meaning that far more younger and future Australians will be lifetime renters compared to their parents and grandparents. As housing becomes less accessible, the fair go turns to a mirage as living standards fall. And there's another important issue to consider as well. The report makes the point that income is not the only economic resource that affects how economic well-being is passed on across generations. Wealth tends to be stickier than income, with people experiencing far lower levels of wealth mobility over their lifetimes. When income is adjusted to account for wealth, over 40% of people in the top or bottom two deciles in 2001 remained there in 2022. Parents, of course, can draw on their wealth to give their children greater opportunities or pass their wealth directly to the next generation. And this could result in the persistence of economic advantage or disadvantage across generations, even if there was little relationship between the incomes of parents and children. So intergenerational wealth mobility is much lower than for income, which is consistent with wealth transfer being much less mobile than income over the life cycle. Transfers and gifts from a parent to their child during their lifetime can also provide substantial advantages in accumulating wealth. This includes parents paying for their children's education so that they do not have any student debt, and contributions to their children's house deposits to enable earlier and greater accumulation of housing wealth. In fact, the latest UBS Global Wealth Report, as reported in AFR, says that Australia now boosts 1.9 million US dollar millionaires, whose combined wealth is now worth about 8 trillion Aussie dollars. But the number of millionaires is set to grow 21% by 2028 and reach more than 2.3 million. The on-paper gains may appear in contrast to how wealthy many people feel as inflation, high interest rates, and low real income and low real wages growth has put pressure on household budgets. But as I highlighted in the recent show, this is a mirage too. Managing Director at UBS Wealth Management Australia, Andrew McCauley, said much of this growth in wealth is down to gains in superannuation and property, while the intergenerational wealth transfer, which UBS values at about 123 trillion Aussie dollars globally, will likely prove distributive. The inheritocracy, the bank of mum and dad, it's real. To be able to afford a house, young people are going to need help, he said. The last of the baby boomers will have retired, and the oldest baby boomers will have started to pass away. There's a real bulge of the population there, and they're the first big group who have super. Definitely, there's going to be a transfer. But of course, this is paper wealth, as most of Australia's household wealth is not real. It's locked up in overpriced housing. So Australia's house price appreciation has actually come at the expense of our children and grandchildren, who, when it's their turn to enter the market, will be required to pay far more for housing than they should, making them poorer. Australia would be a much more equal society and would be much better off financially if our housing costs, say, half as much as it does, and we were not carrying so much debt as a result. Actually, a home has the same function, whether it's valued at $500,000, $1 million, or $5 million. And for the vast majority of people who just live in their homes and don't own investment properties, higher housing wealth is, well, frankly, useless. So standing back, the truth is that the fair-go ideal is dissipating, and people are becoming less mobile economically speaking. Those with wealth in the family will enjoy the benefits, but a large proportion of people are stuck in a poverty rut and have few ways to escape. Bye-bye, fair-go Australia. Now, if you're buying your home in Sydney's contentious market, you don't need to stand alone. This is the time you need to have Edwin Almeida from Ribbon Property Consultants standing alongside you. Buying a property is both challenging and adversarial. The vendor has a professional on their side. Emotions run high. Price discovery and price transparency are hard to find. And then there's the wasted time and financial investments that you make. Edwin understands your needs, so why not engage a licensed professional to stand alongside you? With RPC, you know you have experience, knowledge, and master negotiators looking after your best interests. So shoot
Ribbon an email at info@ribbonproperty.com.au. And if you use the promo code DFAWTW/Martin, you can get a 10% discount offer.
I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Many thanks for watching, and I'll see you again next time.